Good evening. I'm Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Polysports here on Global Patriot Radio. You can find us on blogtalkradio.com. You can find us every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time with the Vito Esposito Show, featuring Vito and Big Al, Mamma Mia No Sharia, and then Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern, unless, of course, I change it, me, Hank Jones with Hank Jones Polysports. Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight, Eastern Time, Minister Usama Dakduk and the beautiful Christie revealing the truth about Islam. Several ways to stay in touch. You can, of course, listen live, get on the internet, go to blogtalkradio.com, choose live, and then go down to the right-hand corner and choose Global Patriot Radio. Or you can do that plus log in. Get an account, log in. It's free. So you can then head into the chat room and hang out with the chatters there. Third way, of course, you can call in 319-527-6706, as Hawkeye Mike has done today. Welcome, sir. And, of course, any other time, you can look me up on Facebook. Just type in Hank Jones Polysports, or go over to Twitter, at HPolysports. Oh, I'm sorry, X, formerly known as Twitter. Other shows, Joseph Gibson, Restoring Our Republic, Tuesday nights, 7 p.m. He does other nights as well on occasion. Audrey Russo at AudreyRusso.com. Annie with Southern Sense Radio. She's Fridays from 1 to 4, I believe. Audrey's on Thursday nights, I believe at 7, but it might be 8 o'clock. Check that out. Go to AudreyRusso.com. Holger occasionally pops up, Tim Tap, Tap Into Truth, all good stuff. I'm hanging out in the official Hank Jones Polysports Space Force Observation Outpost. My mini Aussie was fed slightly before 5 o'clock. Mrs. Hank is over in, or out in Seattle, minding a few things while my daughter is going back and forth. I touched on it briefly. My son-in-law had very serious surgery last Friday. Please keep him in your prayers. You don't have to say a name. Just say Hank's son-in-law. He's recovering. But with the seriousness of the surgery, there are ups and downs during the recovery process, so would really appreciate that. Also, I've talked about several times, Felicia Goodson. Keep her in your prayers as well as she is dealing with cancer. She's going through treatments. Seems to be holding her own and doing fine, but, you know, doesn't change the fact that she's dealing with that. So today's first Internet Laffy. In fact, it's today's only one. It's too good to share with any other Laffy. What it is, it's the 9 best times to light up a cigar. This is good, folks. This is really good. The 9 best times. Number 1, while catching your newborn son as he's delivered. You deserve it, Dad. Pre-cigar. Got to warm up your lungs for the main event. 3, chilling with the boys on your Higgins boat, getting ready to storm Juno Beach. Those Nazis called down the thunder, and now they've got it. 4th best time, post-cigar. Cool down from your smoking experience with a nice, calming cigar. Number 5, in the middle of an important work meeting about appropriate workplace behavior, which lets them know who's really in charge. 6, bottom of the 9th, World Series. Coming up to the plate with 2 outs and you're the winning run. Smoke it all the way around the bases after you crush a homer. Then put it out on home plate. This stuff's great. Number 7, while shirtless and mowing down an entire platoon of South American mercenaries with an M60 machine gun. Once you're done, get to the chopper. Number 8. When you go on an angry tirade to your newspaper staff about that no-good best Spider-Man. you could finally show the entire city what a menace that guy is if that lazy Peter Parker would ever get you a decent photograph of him. And number 9, while your wife says, I think you smoke too many cigars. Once she sees how cool and relaxed you feel lighting up your next cigar right in front of her, she'll be totally cool with it. Oh, that's good stuff. The second one, okay, I misspoke. The second one, Bill Cosby joins Hamas, so feminists will stop condemning him for rape. Oh, my God. That's some pretty pitiful stuff. It's hilarious, though, isn't it? Last week's losses that I deem significant, this is our obituaries, of course. Last Wednesday, I mean the world, lost former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger at age 100. By the way, he was the first person to hold those two positions simultaneously. Thursday, we lost the former lead singer from The Pogues, Shane McGowan, pneumonia and encephalitis at age 65. He'd also had a history of substance abuse. Friday the 1st, we lost former Supreme Court Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor to complications of dementia and a respiratory illness at age 93. She was the first woman, of course, appointed to the court during Ronald Reagan's presidency. She later served as chancellor to the College of William and Mary from 2005 to 2012, served on the Supreme Court from 1981 to 2006. That's weird. She was, and I got these dates right. Apparently she had did a little double dipping. Sunday we lost Miles Goodwin. The name doesn't sound familiar. He was one of the founders of Canadian-American rock band April Wine. He played on every April Wine album. He's credited for their smash hit, Just Between You and Me. Remember that song, Just Between? I should have loaded it, but he retired from April Wine earlier this year due to diabetes and poor health. He was 75. Yesterday, we lost American businessman, philanthropist, and Hall of Fame Archer James Easton at age 88. He served as president of the World Archery Foundation from 1989 to 2005. We also lost former member of the Moody Blues and Wings, guitarist Denny Lane, suffered from interstitial lung disease and passed away after a short illness. He was 79. He was the original lead singer of the Moody Blues, and he's actually credited as a co-founder, along with Paul McCartney, of course, of Wings. He was also kind of used as a play on homophones with a song titled in his name for the spoof imitation Beatles flick The Ruddles. Along with Paul and Linda McCartney, he was the only Wings member to play with them through every incarnation. And he was included into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2018 as a member of the Moody Blues. We also lost longtime screenwriter and producer Norman Lear, the ripe old age of 101. Although his credits are numerous, it's safe to say his biggest, most noted work is the CBS triple he had in the 1970s, and believe it or not, into the 1980s, of All in the Family, Maude, and the Jeffersons. Now, All in the Family continued on as Archie Bunker's place after the death of character Edith Bunker until 1983. The Jeffersons actually lasted from 1975 to 1985. Only Maude was axed before the 1980s. I guess back then it was okay to dismiss a show about angry, egotistical liberals. Now, finally, we lost a Howard Stern Show stylist who then got promoted to wardrobe consultant and set designer. Ralph Sorella died during a routine procedure for lymphoma at age 58. Apparently, Howard Stern was making arrangements for various doctor visits for him and paid tribute to him on his show this morning. Don't forget, my friends, at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center for messaging and answering services for your medical clinic, hospital, service company, large or small. Remember, if you didn't go back to the office after COVID and you still aren't going back, they're perfect for you. They can be your front line on the phones. They also work with remote staff, which serves several purposes, one not the least of which is disaster doesn't take place everywhere at the same time. Give them a call, 800-555-3738, or, of course, look them up on the internet at alliancecommunications.com. Another internet laughy from the Babylon Bee. Okay, now you can say I was just flat out lying about the first one being the only one. This one's good. Public educators warn that low literacy rates may prevent kids from reading about gay sex. Oh, my God. Yeah, I should have known I was going to drop some. So I've got some quickies before we take off. Chris Christie is facing some flack growing GOP pressure to drop out of the presidential race. They say he's dividing the vote. And this little item that I'm about to share might hasten that. Chris Christie's niece could face prison time for violent meltdown. Evidently, she got into a violent meltdown on a flight. She left the jetway after being kicked off Spirit Airlines flight for accusing a Latino family of, quote, smuggling cocaine. She then started attacking the officers who came. She said, "Do you know who I am? I'm related to some very powerful people, and I need to get back on that plane to New Jersey. Do you know who I am? I'm Chris Christie's daughter, and you're so fucked. You will lose your job over this shit. I know Donald Trump." Oh, God. Yeah, I'd say that's a good reason for Chris to drop out of the race. The Alaskan came up with a good on the cigar one. A number 10 reason to light up the cigar. When Hank comes on the air, welcome, Boyd. How you doing today? That's a good one. Yeah, well, fire one up when Hank comes on the air. That's good. Also, some breaking news. Kevin McCarthy has announced that he is retiring from Congress at the end of this year. In other words, 12/31/2023 would be his last day, which really means this Friday is probably his last day since they break for the holidays. So, yeah, they're going to have to Gruesome Newsom of California is expected to hold a special election. Yeah, and some GOPers evidently are worried that McCarthy might use campaign funds to interfere in the primaries of the 8 GOP lawmakers who voted for his removal. Florida Representative Matt Gaetz, who led the little coup, said, "I suspect the former speaker will return to spend more time with the people he's always represented, on Wall Street and K Street. I don't imagine he'll be walking the streets of Bakersfield." Yeah, that one's kind of contentious, ain't it? Yes, it is very contentious. So, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm getting a message regarding work I've got to respond to. Wow, Kevin McCarthy leaving. I am not shocked, but shocked and not shocked, as they say. IRS is issuing their warning to Americans about emerging tax season scams. Issued a warning to both taxpayer preparers and taxpayers. Don't say I didn't warn you. By the way, one person on the Epoch Times website, one person in the comments wrote, "The IRS is a scam." You ain't wrong. And then lastly, an active shooting situation reported at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I don't have the very latest, but I do know the suspected gunman in the shooting on the campus of UNLV has been located and is deceased. So follow that one if you must. Okay, so the groundwork is being laid on several fronts for election manipulation. One story, Democrats have no Biden backup plan for 2024 despite age concerns. I'm not going to go into the whole stuff because we've also seen the stuff that others are being recruited. Supposedly The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, went into some group of military leaders yesterday. Supposedly they're trying to convince him to run for president. Good Lord. And of course the other ones you've seen, what happens if Donald Trump were to die before the election, if he won the nomination or even if he was leading for the nomination and then during the primary process? Think about that. They're laying the groundwork. It's almost like they're telegraphing it, like we should expect this to happen. Susan Sarandon was in the news a couple weeks ago for comments she made at a pro-Palestinian rally. Now, I have to say, the apology she issued seems genuine, and I get part of what she says. This is the Yahoo version. Basically, she says, recently I attended a rally alongside a diverse group of activists seeking to highlight the urgent humanitarian crisis in Gaza and call for a ceasefire. I had not planned to speak, but was invited to take the stage and say a few words. Intending to communicate my concern for an increase in hate crime, I said that Jewish Americans, as the targets of rising anti-Semitic hate, quote, are getting a taste of what it is like to be Muslim in this country, so often subjected to violence. She then continued, this phrasing was a terrible mistake, and as it implies that until recently, Jews have been strangers to persecution, when the opposite is true. As we all know, from centuries of oppression and genocide in Europe to the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh, Jews have long been familiar with discrimination and religious violence, which continues to this day. I deeply regret diminishing this reality and hurting people with this comment. It was my intent to show solidarity to the struggle against bigotry of all kinds, and I am sorry I failed to do so. She concluded with, I hope that we can meet with love and willingness to engage in dialogue, especially with those whom we disagree. Continue her commitment to peace, truth, justice, and compassion for all people. Yeah, she was dropped by her talent agency after that. Now, look, put this all in context. It still was a pro-Palestinian rally. But, look, I do believe Susan Sarandon is not an anti-Semite. I do believe her apology is sincere. And frankly, I actually believe she wasn't planning to speak. It was put up impromptu, and thus probably wasn't in the ideal situation to say much. Now, maybe she should have just shut her mouth or gotten up and said, I hope we can find a peaceful solution. Anyway, I won't necessarily excuse her original comments, but I am willing to cut her some slack in the form of a little partial forgiveness. Put it this way, she is obviously, I mean, look, she's in Hollywood. She has obviously worked with all types in that landscape, film, theater, etc. That would pretty much include every race, color, creed, sexual orientation, and political persuasion. Now, look, while I find most of her political views directly opposite of mine, I also think she's probably not as bad a person as we would often want to believe. Here's an interesting one. This is a Supreme Court case that could, according to our reliable and trustworthy government, cost trillions of dollars. Here's the story from the Epoch Times. Okay, so they're considering constitutional limits on federal taxing power. It's brought by a retired couple, says a 2017 tax on income they never actually received from an investment abroad violates the 16th Amendment. So it's Moore versus the United States. The court could use it to strike down the mandatory repatriation tax, also known as Section 965, transition tax, which was part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act approved by Congress in 2017 and signed into law by President Trump. Conservative constitutionalists say if the Supreme Court finds that the MRT violates the 16th Amendment, which allowed an income tax without having to determine it based on population, such a legal precedent would prevent Congress from enacting legislation to tax wealth. The amendment, original 16th Amendment, ratified in 1913, says Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. Wealth tax proposals routinely come up in Congress. For example, Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, introduced a plan last month to tax the unrealized capital gains of high earners. Liberal groups say it's the most important tax case in a century. It could wreak havoc because a broad ruling could destabilize our tax system, enrich many profitable corporations, and widen existing economic and racial inequalities. They had to drop that one, didn't they? Now, since the 1960s, corporations have been able to move income across borders to avoid taxation. The law is erased. The floodgates to offshore tax dodging could be opened on a scale never seen before, the group said in recent. Actually, no. If it's erased, it would not, well, it wouldn't hurt government in that case. If it's erased, they could tax it. Now, this 2017 law changed the way foreign income of U.S. corporations is taxed. Lawmakers created the tax because, in their view, too much money was being invested abroad and not benefiting U.S. tax coffers. Before the change, much of that income wasn't taxed until it was returned or repatriated to the United States. To transition to the new system, Congress imposed a one-time tax on outstanding, unrepatriated foreign earnings of U.S. corporations. Yeah, the law taxes U.S. corporate earnings abroad going back 30 years, even if the earnings haven't been distributed. The statute also applies to U.S. taxpayers with 10% or more of shares in an overseas corporation as of the end of 2017. The Congressional Budget Office estimated in 2018 that the law would lead corporations to have a one-time tax liability of $347 billion. Charles and Kathleen Moore made a modest investment in India-based Kisan Craft, which supplies power tools to small-scale individual Indian farmers with the aim of helping to make their operations more productive. They had owned Kisan Craft shares for more than a decade but never received any income because the company plowed all its profits back into the business. But after MRT was enacted, the Moores received a bill from the IRS for $14,729 for additional income tax they owed, despite never having received any payments from Kisan Craft. It says, although such profits aren't ordinarily considered income unless shareholders either receive dividends or sell the shares for a capital gain, the MRT attempts to tax these funds as income by simply declaring them to be taxable income, which is a legal fiction, according to the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is providing the couple with legal representation. Now, a divided U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled against them in 2022. Attorney Andrew Grossman said during oral argument that when the 16th Amendment was adopted, the word income referred to gains incoming to the taxpayer, like wages, rent, and dividends. A gain is not income unless and until it has been realized by the taxpayer. Basically, he says this is a tax on the ownership of property. It therefore must be apportioned. Apportionment is a tough burden for tax writing lawmakers to meet. Article 1, Section 2 mandates that direct taxes must be apportioned among the states by population. To be apportioned, a tax has to be the same amount for every person in every state. Wow. Justice Kagan, Elena Kagan, says there is quite a history in this country of Congress taxing American shareholders on their gains from foreign corporations. Mr. Grossman replied, the MRT operates as a tax on property. It doesn't take account of any power that the shareholder had over the income as it was coming in the door to the corporation. Justice Kavanaugh said there was realization in this case by the foreign company. The question then is attribution. Mr. Grossman said, Congress has never reached so far as to tax shareholders of foreign corporations on the active business income of those corporations. Up on a line of questioning begun by Justice Alito, Justice Neil Gorsuch said, if the court were to hold that the only realization requirement is some realization somewhere along the chain by a corporation antecedent to the taxpayer, what would be the consequences of a holding like that? Mr. Grossman said, the consequences would be to open the door to taxation of practically everything. I mean, all property that a person owns is the fruit of income at some point in time, whether it might be income that they received long in the past. Now, Dick Durbin says Justice Alito should have recused himself from the case. based on the fact that Justice was interviewed by attorney David Rivkin, who was participating in the case, for an unrelated Wall Street Journal article. Justice Alito rejected the complaint as unsound and said that Mr. Rivkin interviewed him as a journalist, not as an advocate. And the resulting articles did not reference the case. This is going to get good, folks. Now, it could end up being a whole lot of nothing. And when you think about it, I don't know the situation of the Moors. I suspect they're what we would call wealthy. $15,000, whatever. But the fact that it's getting all the way to the Supreme Court is pretty incredible. Now, it says, if based on a decision in the Maycomber case, which was holy crap, that was way back when. I'm trying to find it when it was referenced earlier. It says, but basically, the court were to invalidate all taxes on undistributed business earnings, it would cause a sea change in the operation of the tax code and cost several trillions of dollars in lost tax revenue. That was from Ms. Preligar of the U.S. Solicitor General, Elizabeth Preligar. Said that the MRT is firmly grounded in the 16th Amendment's text and history. Justice Gorsuch then said to her, asked her if her argument had any limits. He says, because it seems to me there are none. She said, Congress has broad taxing power. The court has said Congress has plenary power. It can tax people just for existing. Justice Gorsuch said Ms. Preligar was willing to overturn 100 years' worth of precedent. Justice Sotomayor suggested that the parties in the case remain far apart. Jeez. She says, I don't fault the parties for shooting for the stars, but I guess the tenor of the questions is that nobody's happy with anybody's definition of anything. Yeah, it could get interesting. Very interesting. I mean, think about it. On the other hand, they talk about that all the time. They always say, well, if we change this tax, then we're going to lose that tax. And I mean, not really affect a lot of us. But who knows? Alaskan asks if I have my cigar lit. He's got his lit. I do not know. He says he has a bad feeling Trump will not take the oath of office even if he wins the election. Others, I know, are afraid that Trump won't leave office. Take that for what it's worth. He left office before. He'll leave again. And taking the oath of office, as much as I agree, Boyd, how important it is, how many of our recent presidents have ignored it in the first place? And a dose of sanity, by the way, yesterday, Supreme Court dismissed the disability tester lawsuit. Now, this was a serial lawsuit filer who has sued more than 600 hotels over their alleged failure to post disability accessibility information on their websites. Activists say such testers are only helping to enforce the provisions of the ADA, which they say hotels do not observe unless they are pressured. Hotel industry counters that some activists abuse the ADA and burden small businesses by initiating dubious lawsuits demanding disability accessibility information. Here's the kicker. This person never planned tells. So they dismissed it. Court threw out the case. So good for them. For them. It's about time they started dispensing with some of this. From NBC News via Yahoo, we get some somewhat disturbing info on four of the gold bars found during the raid on New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez and his wife. Yeah, apparently they are linked to a 2013 robbery. Businessman Fred Dives, or Dabes, reported to police that he was a victim of an armed robbery in 2013, and he asked police to recover the gold bars stolen from him. He reported $500,000 in cash and 22 gold bars were stolen. Records show from Edgewater, New Jersey police. They later caught four people with the stolen goods. To get his property back, Deebs, or Daves, however it's pronounced, signed the property release form certifying the gold bars belonged to him. Each gold bar has its own serial number. They're all stamped. You'll never see two stamped the same way. So in the case of the Menendez bribery indictment, they included some photos of the alleged bribes, including the gold bars. Serial numbers of four gold bars described in the bribery indictment appear to be exact matches to four of the gold bars certified as having been stolen. Wow. Wow. Now, supposedly these were returned to Mr. Daves, or Daves, I don't know, D-A-I-B-E-S. His signature and initial appear on the evidence log, included each specific gold bar and serial number. Menendez says, your report is factually inaccurate, and we look forward to proving it at court. NBC legal analyst Danny Savalos said, this spells bad news for Menendez because the chain of custody, it appears, is going to be really easy to prove up. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Now, Savalos said if Daves gave gold bars to Bob and Nadine Menendez, that alone does not prove the crime of bribery. True. I think Bob Menendez is nailed, but that's just me, Mr. Vegas. Just to show that Trump derangement syndrome isn't a thing. Oh, God, who am I kidding? Of course it's a thing. So, Kelsey Grammer, Frasier, you know, Frasier, BBC interview. Now, he had an interview with the BBC cut short by Paramount Plus representatives after the conversation turned to his support for former U.S. President Donald Trump. One of the co-hosts of the Today program on BBC Radio 4, not the Today Show, recalled that Grammer had mentioned actor and producer Roseanne Barr earlier in the interview. Barr, of course, lost her show over racist comments she posted on Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter, said she was influenced by sleep aid Ambien. So anyway, Webb asked Kelsey Grammer if he was still a supporter of the former U.S. president. Grammer said, I am, and I'll let that be the end of it. After the segment ended, Webb went on to discuss Grammer's comment. I have to say, actually, Kelsey Grammer himself was perfectly happy to go on talking about it. The Paramount Plus PR people were less happy that he talked about it at some length. They decided that we'd had plenty of time for our interview. But I should stress that he was absolutely perfectly happy to talk about why he supports Donald Trump and still does in the coming election. Yeah. So, yeah, Trump derangement syndrome is real. They are basically just sweeping anything positive under the rug. Senator Tommy Tuberville has lifted his hold on hundreds of military promotions. He says he's not going to hold the promotions any longer. We just released them. He did demand roll call votes for the remaining 10 to 11 nominees. Claims that nearly 10-month protest of the Pentagon's abortion policy made its point. Oh, man. Now, Tuberville said, it's been a long fight. We fought hard. We did the right thing for the unborn and for our family, for our military, fighting back against executive overreach. Good for him. He made his point. And it's true. He doesn't have to keep going on about it. He does not. He made his point. So there's that. North Carolina Congressman and Speaker Pro Tem, remember he was the Speaker Pro Tem for a bit? Patrick McHenry has announced he will not run for re-election in 2024. I suspect that was a precursor. He announced yesterday or Monday. I suspect that was basically a team up with Kevin McCarthy. That would be my guess. Sorry, taking a sip of black raspberry sparkling ice. Greg Gutfeld had some choice words for his employer, Fox News, about the censorship industrial complex. Basically, he lambasted the complex, as he called it. He said on Saturday night he praised Elon Musk for telling cowardly advertisers to go F themselves for abandoning X, formerly known as Twitter. He then fired away on Fox for getting rid of Tucker Carlson. He said, the fact is Musk may be the last man standing between real freedom of speech and the suffocating block of this censorship industrial complex, which is made up of government, media, and tech forces. He realizes that advertisers have no spine and can easily be cowed by special interest groups in cahoots with political allies. If you don't believe me, I've got two words for you, Tucker Carlson. Yeah. Again, he's not wrong on that, is he? That's guts to get out there and do that. We now have a mobster weighing in on all the stuff going on with the Bidens. Former mobster shocked by allegations against Biden family. Famed former consigliere of the Gambino family, Salvatore Gravano, shocked audiences of Jesse Waters primetime when the retired mobster turned podcaster said he was stunned by reports on Hunter Biden's activities and those of his family. By the way, Gravano eventually rose to underboss. On November 30th, Gravano told Waters that it is utterly mind-blowing that so little legal action has been taken against the Bidens and that many in power are avoiding addressing the matter, according to American Tribune. It's an incredible, incredible story, he said. It's mind-blowing. I don't understand how the country is just sitting back listening to these things and no action is being taken. He says other people he knows receive 22 lifetime sentences for this kind of stuff. Gravano said the unusual and erratic banking transactions discovered in Hunter Biden's financial records should be scrutinized. He told Waters, without a doubt, I cooperated years ago. Everybody knows it. With the FBI, the federal government, some prosecutors, John Gleason, and different judges. And they were so honest. It was unbelievable. I was proud to be with them for a while. I'm still friends with a lot of them. That's scary. Some of them tell me, Sammy, I spent my whole life in the FBI. I'm embarrassed to tell somebody I'm an FBI agent. And I said, don't feel like that. Just get out. Speak. Talk against it. Do something. I fight for a lot of things. The open borders, poor people pouring in there, invading our country by the million, and we do nothing at all, Gravano said. He called the alleged actions against the Biden family beyond theft. It's treason to a country. And I remember when I was younger and I was in the military, treason was something you'd face the death penalty for because you're robbing every man, woman, and child, every race, black, white, Hispanic, Asian. I mean, you can't get a more disgusting crime than this. Gravano served in the U.S. Army from 1964 to 66 and honorably discharged as a corporal, by the way. He told Fox, the Fox host, Jesse Waters, that he feels for those in the service who served only to return and find the government in such a state. Everything they gave for us, and we're sitting back and doing absolutely nothing. I don't care how much power they got on their side. We have the people. The people are the power. If we don't talk, if we don't say something, then we're part of it. We did things. I don't even want to compare. We're like choir boys compared to these people. He said, even in the criminal underworld, there was an unspoken rule to always protect the public. Okay. Yeah, that part of it, I don't know. You know, here's the thing. Talk about it. I've heard it referenced a couple places now. I can't really, probably on Sirius XM, like on the Patriot Politics channel. I remember one guy talking about, he said, you know, we always talk about John F. Kennedy and the mob. He goes, nobody talks about Biden. He says he's born in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And then before, you know, he's talked about being from Delaware, but he's born in Scranton. And so I had forgotten, you know, Scranton, you know, because it's not called the Scranton family. It's called the Pittstown family or the Northeastern Pennsylvania family. And you're thinking, who is the, you know, who are those guys? Well, Joseph Barbara, who hosted the meeting in Appalachian in 1956 and 1957. Yeah, Joseph Barbara was the boss of the Scranton family at the time. Russell Bufalino ended up taking over at one point. Russell Bufalino, played by Joe Pesci in the movie The Irishman, implicated in the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. So yeah, when we're saying that, when people are saying, oh, the Bidens aren't mobbed up, don't be so sure. Don't be, I'm not saying now, but I'm saying at some point, don't be so sure that they didn't derive some of their power and some of their wealth as a result of mob activity. Just saying. House Speaker Mike Johnson announced yesterday that a formal vote to authorize an impeachment inquiry of Dopey Joe will take place in the coming week, just before Congress breaks for the holidays. There's a story in the Epic Times. I'm not going to go into that. I'm sorry. It's just mainly because it's just – next one doesn't necessarily shock me, but it definitely hacks me off. It's from the Epic Times. Traders informed of Hamas attack profited millions by short-selling Israeli stocks, a study suggests. This is repulsive on the face of it. So the Israeli government is investigating claims by U.S. researchers that some stock traders may have had prior knowledge of the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel and used that information to make millions of dollars by short-selling Israeli companies. The two law professors, Robert Jackson Jr. of New York University and Joshua Mitz of Columbia, said they identified a, quote, sharp and unusual spike in trading in risky short-dated options on Israeli companies in the days leading up. Short sellers bet against companies whose shares they expect to fall in price. They pay a fee to borrow the shares, and then they sell them for the current market price, hoping to make a profit by buying them back for less before the shares have to be returned. They say, our findings suggest that traders informed about the coming attacks profited. They wrote a paper called Trading on Terror. Traders appeared to anticipate events. Significant spike on October 2nd, 5 days before the attack. Basically, short interest in the MSCI Israel Exchange traded funds. And just before the attack, short selling of Israeli securities on the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange increased dramatically. So, wow. Throughout all 3,750 trading days in the 14-year period from the 2008 financial crisis, the short volume on EIS on October 2nd was in the top 99th percentile. It's extremely unlikely that the volume of short selling occurred by random chance, the paper reads. 66-page paper. Other short volumes trading occurred on April 3rd, right before Passover. And if you'll remember, it was speculated that there was going to be a Hamas attack on Passover. That was 94% short ratio. It was higher than every other day throughout the period from March 10th or March 1st to April 3rd. Average short ratio is 38%, 38.87. Wow. Price of one bank dropped from $8.57 a share, $8.57 to $6.60. In just days, with no other reason. That pisses me off. That just pisses me off. They need to find out who those traders are. Comforting news. FBI Director Christopher Wray says terror threats elevated to all-time high. Tuesday, Ray said the terror threat facing the U.S. has hit unprecedented levels since the October 7th attack on Israel. Senator Lindsey Graham asked Ray to describe the current threat matrix during a Senate Judiciary Committee meeting. He said, what I would say is that is unique about the environment that we're in right now in my career is that while there may be have been times over the years where individual threats could have been higher here or there than where they may be right now, I've never seen a time where all the threats or so many of the threats are all elevated, all at exactly the same time. So, blinking red lights analogy about 9/11, all the lights were blinking red before 9/11, apparently, Graham continued. Obviously, all of us missed it. Would you say there's multiple blinking red lights out there? Ray said, I see blinking red lights everywhere. Wouldn't that be nice to know what they are? Just to show that our media has sunk about as far as it can sink, Time Magazine's Person of the Year for 2023, Taylor Swift. Seriously, Taylor Swift is Person of the Year. Good God. I almost long for the days when it was Bruce Lingenner. Time Editor-in-Chief Sam Jacobs said the staff, in going over the choices, chose, quote, joy, unquote, for this year. Newsflash, Taylor Swift brings no joy, at least in my estimation. Oh, sure, she is joyful. What with $1,500 concert tickets, constant exposure, which includes the NFL games she attends to watch boyfriend Travis Kelce, Kansas City Chiefs tight end, owning the media-manipulated song charts for all of the top 10, but joy, holy crap, people. Actually, I guess if they're counting on joy, it's quite easy, given the rather joyless time many have experienced this year. God. A dose of sanity from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Since 2021, of course, the U.S. has struggled with the massive influx of illegal immigration, an estimated 5 million. So a panel of the Ninth Circuit Court ruled Miranda rights don't apply to warrant-backed civil immigration arrests, holding up an order to deport a Mexican citizen who had argued he was coerced into admitting his illegal status under an administrative warrant. Miranda rights are the formal warning given by law enforcement, of course. They decided that Miranda rights are not applicable to arrests involving illegal immigrants. A Mexican citizen tried to get out of deportation at the border. Court decided he was facing a civil deportation, not a criminal trial, and thus Miranda warnings do not apply. But it's a question also, of course, whether a non-citizen, especially one who's here illegally, actually has access to those rights. It says in the case of deportation hearings, no, they don't. So it says it's common for immigration activists to provide legal protection to aliens who come to the U.S. illegally. These lawyers have long used the legal system to help ensure border jumpers can stay in the U.S., often using loopholes to protect them. This ruling could prevent activists from exploiting the legal system for the interests of outsiders. States like Texas have been fighting to find ways to protect their border. So, yeah, a dose of sanity. Going to take a break, and then I'm going to come back, and we're going to talk college football in the wake of all that happened last weekend, whether it be the Hawkeye loss or the disgusting decision by the College Football Playoff Committee. We'll be back. A little Christmas music to keep y'all happy. That, of course, is the Sal Soul Orchestra with Merry Christmas All. We're back. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio. Find us at blogtalkradio.com. Now, I misread what Boyd said in the chat room. He says, I have a bad feeling that Trump will not take the oath of office even if he wins the election. I should have read it a little closer. I was thinking if he wins, he just won't take the oath of office. I think he's saying, and he follows up, I don't think he'll be able to. Yeah, that's a real fear, I think. Especially the way the left has just goes on and on. And as people point out, the left projects when they do that kind of stuff. You know, they say, well, we think there'll be election interference. Well, yeah, because you guys will be doing that. You know, we think there might be fraud. Yeah, of course. You've already proven that. You've already exhibited that. Okay, so last weekend, college football conference championship week, and then the college football playoff committee made their selection. Your four teams for the college football playoff are number one, Michigan at 13-0. Number two, Washington at 13-0. Number three, Texas at 12-1. And number four, Alabama at 12-1. At number five, undefeated Florida State from a Power 5 conference who suffered the fate of being left out due to their number one quarterback going down to injury. So to start, I'm just going to read this from Black Heart Gold Pants. It's a Hawkeye-themed website. I think this totally nails it. It says, when winning no longer matters. On Sunday afternoon, the College Football Playoff Committee announced the four teams selected to take part in the 2023 playoffs and compete for the national championship. Michigan, who soundly defeated Iowa to claim its third consecutive Big Ten title, was predictably slotted as the number one seed, while fellow undefeated conference champion Washington was given the number two seed. Noticeably absent from the top four, however, was another undefeated Power 5 champion in Florida State, who was passed over for a playoff spot in favor of one-loss Big 12 champion Texas and one-loss SEC champion Alabama. Note, folks, before this, Florida State was number four. They did nothing to warrant being knocked down. So that says, with only three undefeated Power 5 teams and four playoff spots to fill, Texas seemed the most likely team to join Michigan, Washington, and Florida State. By virtue of their head-to-head road win over Alabama on September 9th, as well as their strong play down the stretch. However, the decision to include Alabama at the expense of 13-0 Florida State is a baffling one. Seminoles breezed through most of their schedule this season, including a decisive 45-24 neutral site victory over LSU in the opening week, but also proved it could win close games with tightly contested road victories against teams like Clemson and Boston College. They scheduled aggressively in the non-conference by playing two SEC opponents outside the friendly confines of Doak Campbell Stadium. Yes, they beat Florida in Gainesville. And they defeated every team they faced en route to a championship victory over a talented and well-coached Louisville team. However, Florida State's accomplishments on the field were deemed insufficient to outweigh the strength of Alabama's SEC championship victory over a Georgia team that had won the past two national championships and entered last weekend ranked number one. This victory vaulted Alabama from 8-4 in the playoff rankings and was apparently enough to convince the committee that they were a better team than Florida State despite having won fewer games than the Seminoles. The other factor, which hurt Florida State's status, was the seasoning and ending injury to its star quarterback, Jordan Travis. While the Seminoles boasted one of the country's top offenses with Travis at the helm, his injury called into question whether Florida State could score enough points to keep pace with the sport's best teams if they made the playoff. His backup, Tate Rodemaker, completed only 48% of his passes for 134 yards in his first start against Florida, while the third-string quarterback, pressed into duty against Louisville, completed only 8 of 21 for 55 yards. Apparently, the Seminoles' lack of success through the air without Travis was sufficient to justify vaulting Alabama over Florida State based on the assumption that the Noles passing game would not improve prior to the playoff games and that without a dynamic passing attack, the team was undeserving of an opportunity to compete for a championship. The fact Ohio State won the inaugural college football playoff with their third-string quarterback, or that Florida State beating a 10-win ACC team with their third stringer might actually be a testament to how absurdly talented their team is rather than a detriment, Seriously, go watch how bad Alabama's offense was against one of the worst defenses of the country when they played without starting quarterback Jalen Milroe against South Florida. Apparently, that never crossed the committee's mind. There are several problems with the committee to exclude. Yeah, most obvious being that it seemingly invalidates the importance of regular season games. Elevating a one-loss Bama over an undefeated Florida State shows that the playoff committee does not truly value winning as the ultimate metric of a team's success. Instead, defaulting to some nebulous and inherently subjective perception to conclude that Alabama was the better of the two teams. While the committee's job is to select the four best teams rather than the four most deserving ones, the actual outcome of games seems to be the clearest way to determine who the best teams truly are. The outcome of Florida State's 13 games paint them as a superior team to Alabama. Not only did the Noles navigate their schedule without a single loss, to say nothing of having not lost any games at home, Alabama, but they produced a larger margin of victory over their common opponent, LSU, despite the Tigers quarterback going down to injury late in the Alabama game, which, according to the playoff committee's logic, is a near death sentence for a team's competitive hopes. Florida State also played in fewer one-score games than Alabama. And unlike Alabama, who defeated a 4-8 Arkansas squad by only a field goal, all of Florida State's competitive contests came against teams that achieved bowl eligibility. Even Florida State's difficulties putting away their rival Florida in the final week of the regular season paled in comparison to the sheer improbability of Alabama's win over Auburn, when they truly backed into after their probability victory a victory had fallen to 1%. Two arguments in favor of Alabama making the playoff over Florida State are that the SEC champion should not be left out and that Alabama's victory over Georgia was impressive enough to justify the inclusion. However, neither of these arguments stand up to close scrutiny. Perceived SEC supremacy has not been reflected in reality this year. Sorry. Having to respond to another important office thing. However, neither of these arguments stand up to close scrutiny. The perceived SEC supremacy has not been reflected in reality this year. The ACC has a better record than the SEC in non-conference games against Power 5 opponents, 10 of 9 versus 7 of 9, and the committee appears to have conveniently forgotten how poorly the SEC performed in its high-profile early season games. It was only once the SEC started playing other SEC teams that the conference started to look better. Even Alabama's win over Georgia, impressive as it may have been, does not erase the Crimson Tide's loss to Texas earlier in the season. Nor does it inherently mean that they are among the top four teams in the sport. Georgia had similarly struggled against 6-6 teams like Auburn and Georgia Tech and 5-7 South Carolina, and the Bulldogs had not exuded the same air of invincibility that they showed over the past two seasons. Alabama's victory over Georgia could just as easily be seen as proof that the Bulldogs were overrated rather than the evidence that the Tide deserved a playoff berth. So this is where it gets good. Iowa fans who have read this far into the article might be wondering what any of this has to do with the Hawkeyes. Unfortunately, the committee's decision to exclude Florida State could have several damaging effects on college football, even in a world where the sport expands the number of teams that make the playoff. Selecting a one-loss Alabama over an undefeated Florida State unthinkingly reinforces the narrative that the SEC is the strongest conference in college football, despite the lack of evidence to support that assumption this year, while also showing a clear deference to past success as an indicator of future performance. If the actual results of games matter less than the names on the front of a team's jersey or a team's potential to perform well in the future, it invalidates college football as a media merit. Invalidates college football as a meritocracy and casts the playoff as an entity that serves only to advance the interests of the sport's most powerful and lucrative brands, in this case, Alabama and the SEC hype machine. This decision also elevates the importance of individual players, in this case, George Travis, over the success as a team in determining what programs are worthy of a title shot, while also selectively placing added importance on the quarterback position. Texas was not penalized in the playoff rankings for the season-ending injury to star running back Jonathan Brooks, nor was Michigan penalized for the loss of All-American lineman Zach Zinter. However, the loss of Florida State's quarterback was apparently enough to make the committee think they were worse than Alabama, despite the Noles having proven they could win games on the strength of their defense and running game. If wins and losses are replaced by the eye test to determine the best teams, the teams that win games in the most aesthetically pleasing ways, lots of offense and lots of passing touchdowns, will almost always be prioritized over those who win in less conventional ways. Once the playoff expands to 12, how easy would it be for the committee to pass over a 10-2 Iowa team that won games on the strength of its defense rather than elite quarterback play in favor of a 9-3 SEC team that dropped a few games early but is loaded with future NFL draft picks and 4- and 5-star recruits and, quote, has looked really good over the past few weeks, we promise, unquote. When title shots are determined less by what your team has done on the field and more by how you look doing it, how well your team or conference has performed in the past, and how well you might play against elite competition if given the opportunity, teams like Iowa, who lack the preseason hype, sustained history of playoff success, and whose roster looks less impressive on paper than it does in practice, will always be left on the outside looking in. After the playoff field was announced, ESPN college football analyst Booger McFarland, himself an alumnus of an SEC school, correctamundo on that one, called Florida State's exclusion a travesty to the sport. Florida State, who is itself a blue blood program, may not seem deserving of the concern or sympathy of Iowa fans who are understandably focused more on whether their team can recover from their face plant in the Big Ten Championship and rebound with a strong performance in the Citrus Bowl. But if the committee can arbitrarily decide that an undefeated Florida State squad is unworthy of competing for a national championship, believe for a second that they would not do the same thing to deserving Iowa teams in the future. I couldn't say it any better. Another scenario they missed, they talked about 2014 OSU, but they were the first CFP champion, and that was their third-string quarterback. Florida State will get their second-string quarterback returned, but Cardale Jones was the third-string. Remember, they lost Braxton Miller in the regular season, and then they lost second-string quarterback JT Barrett, who, by the way, started the following three seasons, in their season finale that year against Michigan. By the way, Georgia was playing their SEC championship game with two of their premier players, tight end Brock Bowers and wide receiver Ladd McConkey, injuries. And the announcers kept saying they're shadows of their normal selves. So doesn't that alone de-escalate, or doesn't that by definition, does that not mitigate the impressiveness of Alabama's victory? Torquing on a beer. I always torque on a beer during drinking a Shipyard Pumpkinhead Ale, by the way. Anyway, in short, while the whole thing sucks beyond reasonable expectations, I know of no pundits, by the way. I know of no pundits who picked FSU to be left out of the 14 college football playoff the day before. The fact that some of them are coming forward and defending this is ludicrous. Here's another one, and some of it's from Hawkeye fans, which floors me. It says, if either Texas or Bama were to face FSU, who would be favored? Now, it's stupid on the surface, but it's ludicrous when you delve a little into what Hawkeye fans have witnessed this year. First, Oregon was favored over Washington in the Pac-12 championship game. How'd that turn out? Worse, though, to me, is that after we've been railing on the NCAA all season long over the full season suspension of Iowa defensive tackle Noah Shannon for betting $10 on the Iowa women's basketball team in last spring's NCAA tournament, they now use probable betting odds to justify Florida State's exclusion? Think about that a moment. Think about it. And then think a little longer. We rail on the NCAA for their stance on the gambling. Yet the NCAA and the major conferences get paid a boatload for TV rights. And as has been brought on here, brought up on the show before, those TV broadcasts feature gambling ads through. We defended players, rightly so, when they bet on non-football events. But when it comes to screening a team, not just a player, we're okay with using gambling lines to select our four college football playoff teams. Yeah, like I said, it's a bit ludicrous. It's a bit hypocritical, too. Now, Mike says, the good thing is we won't have this problem next year when we go to a 12-team playoff. They're just waiting not to be the angst over who's 12th and who is 13th. Exactly. Recap of the Hawkeyes' loss to Michigan last Saturday in the Big Ten Championship game. Offense, part one. By the way, the Hawkeyes lost the game 26-0. Yes, there were bad calls, but it had nothing to do with them losing. Offense, part one. For a guy on his way out, Hawkeye offensive coordinator Brian Ferentz left probably most fans, but definitely me, left me as confused as he ever has. We ran into the teeth of the Michigan defense between the 20s. We literally ran into the middle every time. We run the same jet sweep or wide receiver reverse to the same guy multiple times. We ran no other exotics or atypical plays throughout the game. But we run straight drop back passes with our backs to the goal line. What the hell? I, for one, simply don't get it. I can't even say or decide whether I think Brian Ferentz is just out of his element or simply isn't a good play caller. I mean, he seems as stuck in his routine as any coach I've ever seen. And while this is the same guy that destroyed Ohio State in 2017, which was his first season as offensive coordinator, he did follow that up the following week with this output of 66 yards against Wisconsin. The same guy who, now admittedly, he rode Nate Stanley, Tyler Goodson, Amir Smith-Marset, Brandon Smith, and Sam Laporta to an absolute down over USC in the 2019 Holiday Bowl in 2019. It's the same guy who spent 2021 and 2022 doing the same thing over and over, going run heavy when we needed to pass, going to the air when we needed to keep the ball on the ground. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. Offense part two. Turnovers and penalties certainly killed us. Three lost fumbles, one of which resulted in a TD the following play. Yes, the fumble was an incomplete pass. Yes, replay inexplicably overturned the call. Yes, Brian Ferentz went ballistic and drew an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty, which, given where the ball was meaningless anyway. Michigan scored on the next play. In short, 120 passing yards and net 35 rushing yards will not win games against good teams, especially good teams with very good to great offenses. Penalties, the fault starts aside, I found it amazing that officials were so keen to spot apparent block in the back infractions during Hawkeye kickoff or punt returns, but missed two somewhat, I thought, obvious blocks in the back by Michigan on their long punt return that set up their first touchdown, which brings me to special teams. No Cooper DeJean meant no special teams heroics. Mike pointed out Michigan's two touchdowns came in a total of 11 yards in drives, 5-yarder and a 6-yarder. Or actually, the 5-yarder was two plays. 6-yard drive and a 5-yard drive. But no Cooper DeJean meant no special teams heroics, save one. Save one. Now, that was a play by Kane Entringer, where he ran all the way downfield to cover the punt. This is on the long return by Michigan. He missed the initial tackle opportunity. Then he turned and returned all the way back downfield to save the punt return touchdown. It's flat out incredible. To get specific, he ran roughly 52 yards downfield to cover the punt, then turned and ran roughly 87 yards, plus or minus, back toward the Iowa goal line and pushed the punt returner out of bounds at the Hawkeye 5-yard lines. Absolutely amazing play from Cone Ettringer. Now, on the punting front itself, Hawkeye Torrey Taylor averaged 50.4 yards on 7 punts, 8 yards better than Michigan's Tommy Dolman. The only kick by the Hawkeyes was a kickoff by Drew Stavins, which resulted in a touchback, which was nice to see maybe Drew getting back in form. Defense, the Hawkeyes, as usual, were lights out. Unfortunately, so was Michigan's defense. And it is a good defense. It's a very good defense. It's just unfortunate weird here. Okay, so as I said, the Hawkeyes were lights out. Absolutely lights out. But so was Michigan. Hawkeye linebacker Jay Higgins had 14 tackles. His usual stellar self. He's just, you know, I keep harping on this, how I called it last year, really, and all up to this year. But I was right. The guy is amazing. He just goes where the ball is. We held Michigan to 147 passing yards and 66 net rushing yards, which is a low for Michigan during all of the Jim Harbaugh era, which began in 2015. How it used to be that if you held Michigan to 213 total yards, the only way that the Hawkeyes could lose is by gaining even less yards and having turnovers and penalties. That's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. We had penalties, three or four false start penalties alone. We had the block in the back penalties, which nullified good returns. We had the Brian Ferentz penalty. I give him a pass on that. But that's exactly what happened. But the play calling, I'm sorry. We run into the teeth of the Michigan defense between the 20s, and we throw with our backs to the goal line. What? And in a drop back, not play action, and just a drop back. Some other Hawkeye notes. Cooper DeJean had an interesting post on Instagram where he made this statement. Who says I'm leaving? Now, if this ends up being the case, it will be a major quasi-recruiting coup, like on the level of 1985 when Hawkeye quarterback Chuck Long decided to stay for the 1985 season. Quarterback Cade McNamara has said he plans to stay next year. If either or both of the tight ends stay, it makes the 2024 season look a lot less gloomy. If Jay Higgins were to stay, my God. Now, look, in the case of Jay Higgins, go get paid, young man. Let your incredible dad have a little rest. I'm sure whatever Roy does, he loves what he does, but by gosh, he alone has made all of this bearable over the last couple of years. No, if Jay Higgins stays, oh my God. But I'm not counting on it. And he shouldn't. I mean, part of me says he really shouldn't. He's so ready for the NFL. On the transfer portal front, tons of players across the country have already entered. Now, to me, two of the most surprising offense, Ohio State quarterback Kyle McCord and Oklahoma quarterback Dylan Gabriel. Now, Washington State quarterback Cam Ward and Oregon State quarterback DJ Uiagalelei, I'll just call him DJU, they both entered. But that's not surprising because the teams they play for, Oregon State and Washington State, are effectively playing a Mountain West conference schedule next season. Plus, Oregon State head coach Jonathan Smith has taken the job at Michigan State. So the expectation is that's where DJU is going to end up heading, which is probably the reason, by the way, that all three Michigan State quarterbacks that saw action this year have also entered the portal. So for Hawkeyes, defensive tackle Ontario Thompson, wide receiver Deontay Vines, defensive back Brendan Diaz-Fernandez, defensive lineman Jackson Filer, his father Rodney, played at Iowa, and the last one, to nobody's surprise, quarterback Joey Lavis. Hawkeye defensive back Cooper DeJean and punter Torrey Taylor were named first-team All-American by USA Today. Hawkeye linebacker Jay Higgins was named to the second team. Let's see what else. Former Hawkeye offensive lineman and Outland Award winner Robert Gallery was inducted finally into the College Football Hall of Fame. He's the 11th Hawkeye that made the Wall of Honor, by the way. And in what should have been a runaway, though we may never know, Iowa defensive coordinator Phil Parker was named the winner of the Broyles Award yesterday. Now, that award is named after former Arkansas legendary coach Frank Broyles, given to the nation's top assistant coach. It's well-deserved, and it's a wonder that he hasn't won it previously. Given the defenses he has led the last decade or so, this really should be his second or his third Broyles Award, but at least he finally has one. And I think his players love playing for him. Moving on. Big Ten bowls for this season. We have Northwestern versus Utah in the Las Vegas Bowl on December 23rd. Now, I don't know the lines on these, so I'm just going by gut feel. Utah started strong, no doubt about that, but they faded down the stretch, most definitely. On the other side, Northwestern's star is ascending. They have Big Ten Coach of the Year, David Braun, whereas Utah, remember Kyle Whittingham, their coach, said earlier in the summer, or late, maybe sometime in the summer before the season, that Utah to the Big 12, which is happening next year, he didn't even really think that that's necessarily their final destination. So I wonder if they're just going to phone it in. I'm going to preliminarily, Big Ten teams, do not do well in the West Coast or in the Western time zones. They typically don't. There are the outliers, such as Iowa's 2019 Holiday Bowl victory, but they typically don't. But I'm going to call Northwestern for this one. They have momentum. They're on a positive swing. They had the big win over Wisconsin, which I know it's not huge, but it was big enough. I'm going to go with Northwestern over Utah. Next up, 5-7 Minnesota. They got in on a technicality because there weren't enough 6-6 teams to fill out the 43 bowls we now have, or 43 games with 42 bowls. 5-7 Minnesota takes on Bowling Green in the Quick Lane Bowl on December 26th. Play New Mexico State. I forgot the bowl, but that would have been interesting because they would have been facing their former coach, Jerry Kill, who's had a good year at New Mexico State. They had that big 21-point win at Auburn a few weeks ago. Would have been cool to see that. I don't care. I'm picking Bowling Green. I know that we should say, well, the Big Ten's tougher, but no. Mike said it best. Northwestern is a team you don't want to play right now. Totally agree. Totally agree. But no, I'm going Bowling Green in the Quick Lane Bowl. By the way, Minnesota is going to be without a lot of guys. They've had several guys enter the portal, including their starting quarterback. Their starting quarterback, Atan Kaliakmanis. Let me look this up real quickly because I was shocked to see that. And I'm going to look it up. Football players in the transfer portal 2023. They did add a guy named Max Brosner, the New Hampshire quarterback. Yeah. Well, then again, we picked up Deacon Hill, so. So here's the list of Gopher players. Quarterback Athan Kaliakmanis, quarterback Drew Viato, offensive lineman J.J. Gidey, defensive end Colton Gregerson, wide receiver Zach Jorgensen, running back Marquise Williams, running back Max Grand, kicker Jacob Lewis, wide receiver Dino Kaliakmanis, I assume is Athan's brother, at running back Zach Evans. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, they're talking about it. Marquise Williams was a prized recruit from Pennsylvania. So that'll be interesting. And then the other running back, Evans. Backfield is now down to Darius Taylor II and Jordan Newbin. So Minnesota is going to go into that bowl game, presumably with 6 or 7 players down. So, yeah, Bowling Green in a landslide. Rutgers takes on Miami, Florida in the Pinstripe Bowl on December 28th. Look, that's in their home. That's in their backyard. I'm going Rutgers all the way. Rutgers, I mean, we beat them 22-0, Iowa did, but they're not a bad team. Interesting one. Number 7, Ohio State versus number 9, Missouri in the Cotton Bowl on December 29th. Again, unless something changes, Ohio State quarterback Kyle McCord, starting quarterback Kyle McCord, is presumably not playing in that game. Now, there was mention somewhere that after the Michigan game, head coach Ryan Day, had said, you reevaluate everything after that loss. It's the third loss in a row to Michigan. Well, Kyle McCord was only quarterback for one of those. But he says, yeah, you reevaluate everything, and everything's on the table. I think Kyle McCord saw that and said, fine, I'm out of here. He was probably told you're going to be probably losing playing time without significant improvement. So, yeah, Ohio State's going to the Cotton Bowl without starting quarterback Kyle McCord. Number 10 Penn State takes on number 11 Ole Miss in the Peach Bowl on December 30th. Now, in the Ohio State game, I don't know. Marvin Harrison Jr., is their star wide receiver, is going to the Heisman ceremony this Saturday. He's not going to win it, but at least he got the invite. But you got to question whether he will stay for this bowl. If he doesn't, then yeah, it's all Missouri. As it is, I'm not sure I don't pick Missouri anyway. I think Ohio State just has that letdown after 3 straight losses to Michigan. Number 10 Penn State versus number 11 Ole Miss in the Peach Bowl. I'm going to go with Penn State. I think their defense can hold MSU, and Ole Miss, who does not have the best defense. Maryland versus Auburn in the Music City Bowl, also December 30th. Go Maryland there. Auburn is not a good team. Yes, they had a performance against Alabama, but losing by 21 points at home to New Mexico State, go Maryland. Wisconsin versus LSU in the ReliaQuest Bowl. That's what used to be the Outback Bowl on January 1st. LSU all the way. Wisconsin is a very average team right now. Number 17, Iowa versus number 21, Tennessee in the Citrus Bowl, which is also January 1st. I'll talk more about that in the coming weeks. I'm not going to make a choice today. I mean, I'm going to pick Iowa. You know I am. And finally, number 1, Michigan versus number 4, Alabama in the Rose Bowl, which is the first of 2 college football playoff games that are played on January 1st, the second being the Sugar Bowl, I believe, that evening with number 2, Washington, taking on number 3, Texas. I'm going to go with Michigan. I hate Harbaugh. I hate their fans. I hate the ways the obnoxious, just arrogant fans. But I want Michigan to show that Alabama did not belong in the college football playoff. And I actually think they can. I don't think Bama's defense is that great. Certainly good. I mean, it's always good. But I think Michigan's defense is good enough to slow down Alabama's offense. I don't think the idea of a mobile quarterback or a dual-threat quarterback really affects Michigan that much. You know, Iowa's defense got a lot of play coming into that game last Saturday. But Michigan's defense is the equal of Iowa. In fact, they led the nation in scoring defense. So, look, I'll give this. A lot of Michigan fans did come on to a call-in shows, like Corey Breda's podcast, the Hawkeye from the Hawkeye of the Storm, and several of them came on and did say, boy, that defense, holy crap, too bad Iowa doesn't have an offense. So, yeah, we held Michigan's offense. I mean, I don't think Bama can. So I'm going to go Michigan. I'm going to go Iowa in the Citrus Bowl against Tennessee. We might have some sit-outs. I don't think so. The guys that have declared for the portal, did I mention Deontay Vines? I thought I did. Who were the – I mentioned it. I thought I mentioned that the who the Hawkeyes were in the portal, but I don't know that I mentioned Deontay Vines. Yeah, I did mention Deontay Vines. He's been ineffective the last several weeks, so he's not a factor at this point. But assuming everyone else besides portal, Joey Levis wasn't going to play. Brendan Diaz-Fernandez wasn't going to play. Antonio Thompson, special teams, but he's, you know, that's certainly plug and play for the most part. Jackson Filer, again, has not been playing. So there you go. I'll delve more deeply into the bowl scenarios in the coming weeks. Suffice it to say, the 14-team Big Ten having 9 teams playing in bowls really kind of does give credence to wanting and liking a return to the good old days when only a few teams made bowl games. Hell, up until 1974, technically 1974, the Big Ten only allowed one representative. That was their champion in the Rose Bowl. After OSU, folks may not remember, in 1973, Michigan and Ohio State were both undefeated. They played their final game, as they always do, and they tied 10-10. It was the 1973 season. They not only tied for the title, but also tied in the final game. Big Ten athletic directors had to vote, and they made the recommendation to the league's chancellors. Well, first, they voted to be Ohio State to be the representative. What was the reason? Well, one, Michigan quarterback Dennis Franklin broke his collarbone in that game. But they're not saying, I mean, it wasn't great, but they're not saying that Michigan didn't deserve to be there. They're just saying they had to pick one. It was unfortunate. It was unfair. Stupid. But Big Ten athletic directors then made the recommendation to the chancellors and presidents, you know, that, look, other leagues are sending multiple teams, and if we're going to keep pace, we've got to do it. Thus, Michigan, 2 seasons later, became the first non-champ to go to a bowl, going to the Orange Bowl against Oklahoma after the 1975 season of Archie Griffin's 2 Heisman trophies for Ohio State. He won 74 and 75. So, yeah, you know, I get that it's good to have some teams in, but 9? I mean, we're literally watching 5-7 Minnesota, who's getting in on, at least they're getting in the right way. They're getting in for academic progress rate. They have the highest academic progress rate of all 5-7 teams in the NCAA. I mean, yeah, you could say it's like being the tallest midget, but at least it's being based on academics. They're giving some credence still to the academic part of it. But still. I mean, Nebraska was 5-7 back in 2015, and they went to a bowl. They actually won. But no, I long for the days when we don't have this. Now, it's a hard one for me to say, because when I first got to Iowa, my first semester was 1980, and at that point, multiple teams were going to bowls already. But the next year, they went to the Rose Bowl, and it was great. Following year, they made the Peach Bowl. They went 7-4, but coming off of a Rose Bowl season where they had lost so many, they were picked to finish 7th, anywhere from 7th to 9th the following year. I remember reading one of the preseason magazines that says, you know, no, this is not a year for the Hawkeyes. They shot their wad last year. To go 7-4 and make the Peach Bowl was pretty significant, and to win it as well after they'd been embarrassed in the Rose Bowl. So that was kind of a good reward. And then thereafter, they started making bowls with regularity. Now, have the Hawkeyes been there, you know, where they've had, they've had a couple of years. They were 6-5 or 6-6 one year and gone to bowls. And you wonder, did they deserve them? But you ask a coach, they're never going to turn down the extra practices. They're never going to turn down the extra time. But Mike points out, with a 12-team playoff, hopefully it'll eliminate a lot of the bowls. I still hope they keep some. But, yeah, you know, really, if you can't make the 12-team playoff, you're not going to be that satisfied, I don't think, with the Palpitation Bowl or whatever you want to, you know. I mean, I just don't. I don't think so. Maybe that's going to help it. Maybe that is. But again, I see the other side of it. There is a reward. You know, and I'm not talking about going 6-6, but, you know, you go 8-4 or 9-3, yeah, that's a decent season. You would like to have a bowl environment. But those bowls will change after the 12-team playoffs. I mean, I'm thinking maybe 12 teams in the playoff and maybe have 6 bowls with 12 more teams. Simple as that. And even rotate how it is. So don't have the Big Ten be in the same bowls every year. Don't have them playing people from the same conference. Figure out a way to work it. I mean, it's not like they have to, that they're messed up with travel plans, because already they already have short notice on to where they're going to make their travel plans. They get basically a month. So that's not a factor. It shouldn't be. So yeah, why not? I can see that. Why not have a 12-team playoffs and then have a 12-team secondary bowl level? Play them all before the final playoff games, but start them when you have the, you know, if you start the playoff games to follow 2 weeks or whatever, don't start them right after, but, you know, maybe start them Heisman Day. I don't know. But no, you got to keep Army-Navy that. Army-Navy is the lone game. That's this Saturday. That deserves its own spot. Absolutely. And then the Heisman announcement that night. So, yeah, start playoffs the following week. Now, people, what about finals? Oh, Jesus. Let's stop pretending that it's that insurmountable. There are ways to do it. There are ways to handle it. God, the way that everything has gone so online now with education, please. So do that. You know, have those, because they say you're going to have 8 teams play, and those 4 winners will then take on the top 4 seeds. And on that day, you know, why not have, you know, that's 4 games, so why not have 3 bowl games that day as well? Have the playoff games in the evening, the bowl games at 11 a.m. Eastern time, and then have 3 the following week when you've got your final 4 in the, or no, you wouldn't. You'd have your final 8. So have, you know, that's 4 games, and then have 3 more games. And have your 4 playoff games again in the evening, and have your bowl games in the, you know, 11 o'clock. All of them. Start at the same time. No need for TV to separate them out, because that's ESPN-driven. Screw ESPN. Let them rotate the networks if they want. No reason for ESPN to have an exclusive on that. That's part of what drove the problem. That's part of why Florida State is not in the playoff. Trust me, ESPN and their rankings and their money has a lot to do with that. And I love the fact that Disney is going through so much that they may have to sell ESPN. That's awesome. So that's pretty much it for this week, folks. I protected the rant. I did not want to go on to a major rant, which is why in some cases I have it's the reason I do this, by the way, is when I sometimes read news articles to you rather than go right from commenting, because I will go ballistic. And I'm really – at a time I was driving home from a paddle Sunday talking to Brother Tommy about the Hawkeye game. And he goes, oh, yeah, they screwed Florida State, by the way. And I was like, what? I couldn't believe it. I damn near had to pull over just so I wouldn't piss my pants. Unbelievable that they did that to Florida State. Unforgivable that they did that to Florida State. Look, the Minnesota game for Iowa, when we had that overturned punt return, that was egregious. The call last Saturday for what they called an incomplete pass by Deacon Hill, a fumble. That was egregious. It wasn't maybe as egregious as the punt return overturning, but and one explanation to Coach Kirk Ferentz was his hand, his arm was moving forward, but his hand was not. Please explain that one to me. Are there any doctors out there, any kineticists or kinesiologists, any experts on motion that can please explain to me how Deacon Hill's arm was moving forward, but his hand was not? What the hell? What the hell? Please explain that. Nevertheless, we lost. We were going to lose. We knew it. We expected a little more. We expected at least some competitiveness, and we were competitive. We just – look, I feel for Brian Ferentz losing his job. I feel for Kirk having his son no longer be with the program. All that. I get it. I'm in sympathy. I worked in the family business for 36 years, 20 of it with my father. When I lost my father, it was I was a zombie for almost 2 years in the office. It's tough working with your father for so long and then, you know, having that taken away. Mike asks, who's going to be the new offensive coordinator? I don't think we know until after the bowl game. I think we might have some inklings. I think there are people within the school that may know, within the athletic department. Maybe even Brian knows. Who knows? And they may be having to tell recruits something, but I don't think we're going to get an announcement until after the bowl game. Either that, or Brian Ferentz is going to bow out of the bowl game, and we'll get John Budmeyer for the game itself, and then, you know, move on from there. I hope it's not Budmeyer for the – because he's been working with our quarterbacks the last 3 years. Or 2 years, I think, 2 or 3 years. He brought us Deacon Hill from Wisconsin. Now, look, I don't know what Joey Labus was looking like. I don't know if they just didn't want to put Marco Linez into the mix, into the fire. So we can be at least a little grateful for Deacon Hill. For those that want to rank on him all the way, by the way, be a little grateful for Deacon Hill. He gave it everything he had this year. No, he wasn't what we wanted. He wasn't Cade McNamara. He wasn't Nate Stanley. But don't say he was. He's not intending to screw up. He's a football player, man. He wants to win. Cut him some slack. But no, I think Mike. I would say if we find out if it's before the bowl game, then I would guess it's because Brian is not going to coach the bowl game and John Budmeyer is going to step in. Either that or John Budmeyer is shadow OC right now during practices. He cannot be on the field or in the booth during a game as a consultant. But he can, I think, probably take part in practices. Probably would have to get some kind of special permission, but so that wouldn't surprise me if he's going to be named the permanent. Otherwise, no. If he's just, there'd be no reason for, and I retract that. Brian is going to coach through the bowl game. So I don't think we'll find out publicly until after the bowl game. And I have no idea who they're going after. I mean, everybody's talking about all these different people. I don't know. It's Kirk Ferentz's problem. You know, I've said before when talking about politics or sports, I'm not an insider. I'm not. I don't want to be. But, yeah, it's a very important hire. I mean, it would be like, you know, let's think in the case of Nixon, when he had to hire Kissinger as Secretary of State. I mean, that's a pretty important hire. Mike says, Paul Crist, it wouldn't shock me. I've seen Twitter memes, or I should say X, formerly known as Twitter, memes with Paul Crist, you know, photoshopped with a Hawkeye cap on. It would not bother me. Now, some people say, oh, what's Crist really done? No, it wouldn't bother me in the least to see Paul Crist as our next offensive coordinator. Why not? He had some success at Wisconsin. The way Wisconsin got rid of him, I think, is going to be feeling that for several seasons, by the way. Wisconsin did not have a good year this year. And I think part of that is, one, firing Paul Chryst and then not giving the job to Jim Leonard. Luke Fickle, will he get it together? I don't know. Luke Fickle, when he spent a year at Ohio State, and he went 6-6. And you're thinking, well, it was an interim and all that. Yeah, it's still Ohio State. I mean, Urban Meyer came in there. He didn't go 6-6 right away. He went a little better than 6-6. So, no, I would not be upset at all with Paul Chryst. Be a little surprised, but I would not be upset. By the way, people that keep talking about the Stoops brothers, stop it, please. They are defensive coaches. Put that out of your mind. I would not mind Chuck Long. I don't hear his name thrown around much, but I sure as hell would love Chuck Long. I think he's a good offensive mind. I think he's a good person. I think he would have the respect of his players and the staff members. I met him once or twice when I was in college. He's a nice guy. A really nice guy. So, yeah, I think I'd love to see Chuck Long. I think it may very well be someone that is an up-and-comer, not a proven track record as an offensive coordinator on the Power 5 level. You know, so, well, I mean, Kirk Ferentz had never coached at the Power 5 level as a head coach. He had head coaching experience at the University of Maine. That was it. He had certainly had, you know, offensive line coach experience, but he'd never even been a coordinator. And by the way, I don't think a coordinator position is necessary to elevate to head coach. And I wish Kirk had followed that in the case of his son, Brian, because I don't think elevating Brian to coordinator did him any favors. So, yeah, I would love Chuck Long. That would be one of my choices. I don't think he will be. He works for, I believe, the Iowa Foundation or the Iowa. I think he was working for Iowa Special Olympics at one point, but I don't know. You know, Chuck does podcasts and he gets on TV. Mike asks if Kirk would retire after the bowl game. That would not shock me, but it would shock me because I think he has said enough in recent weeks that no, he's going to stay. This is what he does. It's what he loves. So no, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't. A lot of people, Kirk will take his ball and go home. Nah. No, people say, oh, Brian didn't wear his Hawkeye gear. He wore Hawkeye gear Saturday. I don't get, by the way, those of you, if any Iowa fans are listening besides Mike, I do not get the obsession with what Brian is wearing. As manager Ian Faith said in This Is Spinal Tap, you sound like a bunch of Ponzi hairdressers. Good God, why do you care what Brian Ferentz wears on the sidelines just because he's no longer, you've been announced that he's being let go? And you're thinking, yeah, he's that way. Why do you care? Think you would not want him to wear it, by the way. Okay, folks, that's it. I'm fresh out of good material, and frankly, I've got to get up at 4:00 tomorrow morning. I've got to paddle out of town. That's going to be fun, but I've got to get ready for it. I got some work to do, and we've only got 10 minutes left anyway. So, hey, have a good rest of your week. Have a great weekend. Be ready for Christmas. It's the season. I mean, I'm not taking it totally serious yet. We got a lot of work to do before Christmas. So, but have a great holiday season. I hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving. It sounds trite, but hey, man, revel in the joy of Christmas. Revel in the joy of what this season means. And if you're one that just revels in the secular side of it, that's okay too, frankly, because I think the secular part is important. Because I think it's the secular is what draws people to the meaning of Christmas in the first place. I don't think you have Christians without exposure. And that's one form of exposure. So have a good Christmas season. In the meantime, I send you off with good closing music. Have a good one, folks. Be back next week, 6 Eastern Time. I want to thank the Alaskan Boyd for being in the chat room, Mike for listening on the phone. Any of you listening out lurking, I appreciate you doing that. In the meantime, go Hawks. Have a good night, folks. God bless.